got my bags packed and on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. I'm looking real good in my passport photo.
Amateur Traveler, episode 167. Today the Amateur Traveler goes to Israel. We'll be talking nightclubs in Tel Aviv, the four names for the Sea of Galilee, and the Holy City of Jerusalem today on the Amateur Traveler.
I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not today.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into today's interview, I do have some news stories for you. The first one you probably heard about already. It's a big news item at the time that I'm recording this, and that is that nine Muslim passengers were kicked off an Air Trans flight because of an unfortunate comment that was misconstrued. One of the passengers said, "Wow, the jets are right next to my window. Someone thought that was suspicious. FBI was brought in. They were taken off. They were rescreened." The most outrageous part of this story, though, is that even after the FBI agents cleared them, the airline wouldn't allow them back on the plane. The FBI told them there's no suspicious activity here. They are clear. Please let them on the flight so they can go on their vacation, and the airline refused. I think you can expect that that's going to blow up into a bigger problem. And speaking of problems for airlines, I saw an article that had some new outrageous airline lawsuits. One, a German man sued British Airlines after being kicked off a flight when a fellow passenger complained about the way he smelled. He lost the suit because it turned out that British Airlines' conditions of carriage allow it to expel extra stinky passengers. Bet you didn't know that. In another case of a bad seatmate, a flyer sued Delta Airlines after spending a flight next to an obese man who claimed he infringed on his space. The plaintiff claimed that he was given less than the full seat guaranteed by his ticket. The case was settled out of court. Another passenger sued Delta Airlines for post-traumatic stress disorder after her bag was, quote, found to be emitting a buzzing sound. A female passenger was called to the tarmac for further inspection. The source of the suspicious sound turned out to be a vibrator, which left the airline workers, quote, laughing hysterically. She lost the case. For links to both those stories, as well as stories about drunk pilots and how to prevent a monkey attack, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome Douglas from Cincinnati to the show, who's come to talk to us about Israel. Douglas, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
And I realize this is a little weird as a time to talk about traveling to Israel because Gaza Strip and Israel are having a problem right now where they're throwing rockets and bombs at each other. So, Douglas, first of all, is this a time where you would actually travel to Israel or would you wait?
Absolutely, I would travel and I would do so without hesitation. And some of that comes from the fact that I've been there nine times and my very first trip was November of 1988 at the height of the first Palestinian uprising.
Oh my,
and
wow,
I went by myself in a rental car, ran all over the country, walked over every inch of Jerusalem I could find for 2 weeks by myself and never once was afraid. Frankly, that would have been a far more risky time than
sure.
now, because
mm-hmm.
this conflict is, at this point, confined to the Gaza Strip and the areas of Israel that immediately border it. And frankly, where tourists would go in Israel are just nowhere near there. Now, I'm not naive about the risks. There
right.
is certainly some increased risk of Hamas-sponsored terrorism as a result of this conflict. That is a possibility. But I know your listeners come from all over the world, but most of them are Americans. And one of the things I'm often having to remind Americans is to overcome their own denial about how dangerous life is in the United States.
Right. Sure.
I absolutely feel far safer anywhere in Israel than I do in downtown Cincinnati, my hometown. And I have statistics that fairly much back that up. And that sounds stunning to people whose whole image of Israel is shaped by what they see on CNN and so forth.
Sure.
But that is the reality. And I just spoke yesterday with a friend of mine in Jerusalem who assures me that the climate there, while people are having to be more aware, is certainly still very peaceful. And I think it would be really a missed opportunity for people not to go because of this and not a realistic assessment of the risks.
And one of the reasons that I've invited Douglas to come on and talk about Israel is that you were recommended to me by someone who said, I think they had gone to Israel, and you have a travel guide that you've written, not because this is a profession for you, but out of your passion for Israel. Why Israel?
It's a hard thing to explain, but I think it's because there is no place in the world I can think of that offers such an amazing range of sites, experiences, things to do in such a tiny country. The country is about the size of New Jersey or Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's physically tiny. But within that country, the ability to experience this incredible range of cultures, history, things to do, from trend-setting nightclubs to the most important religious sites in the world. I can't think of any place else that offers that. And it has a way of grabbing on to people and not letting them go. On the TripAdvisor Israel forum, which I'm very active on, we have a number of people like me, non-Jews, who have become absolutely addicted to Israel based on even going there one time. We call it getting the bug. And Israel also, just moving aside from sort of the obvious things people know, its religious significance and its history, has a spectacular range of climate and topography, particularly for such a small country.
Mm-hmm.
In the far north right now, especially in the wintertime, you've got on Mount Hermon ski resorts and a snow-capped mountain.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
The far south, arid, scorching deserts. We'll try to figure all of that happening in a place the size of New Jersey. It's just extraordinary. And I think the reality is Israel is a small, tiny place that's captured the world's heart and attention for thousands of years. The faith of billions of people stems from this little place.
Right.
I've become addicted to it, I must say.
And if we had a trip planned to Israel and we only had a week or 2 weeks, the typical, I don't have enough time, but I have so many places I want to see, what would you recommend? What's a recommended itinerary? Where would you start? What would you see?
Well, I would recommend, if people can do it, I know it's not always possible, but if people can, I would spend 2 weeks.
Okay.
I'm going to start with 2 weeks, and then I'll adjust it for a week-long itinerary.
Sounds great.
If you had 2 weeks, I would start with Tel Aviv and spend 2 to 3 nights there, including the night of the arrival, because the airport is between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. By the way, that confuses people sometimes, despite the fact that the airport has the TLV designation. It's not in Tel Aviv. It's actually between the two cities.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend spending the first 2 to 3 days there, Tel Aviv being the part of modern commercial business Israel and sort of the modern side of Israel. And then drive up the coast to a beautiful city called Haifa on the Mediterranean, sitting on a crescent-shaped bay. It's often compared to Naples. Spend a couple of days there. Then go east across Galilee to Lake Kinneret area, which is the modern name for the Sea of Galilee,
mm-hmm.
Tiberias being the main city, and spend a couple of days there because that region is fascinating, and particularly for Christians is extremely important. And then go the entire second week in Jerusalem.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Okay.
You could spend a month in Jerusalem and not run out of things to do. And it's so packed with so much that it would be a major mistake to skimp on time in Jerusalem. From Jerusalem, it's also easy to do a day trip to go to the Dead Sea and see Masada, which, of course, is a very significant site. So that's kind of the basic breakdown. A week, I would say a couple of days in Tel Aviv, maybe 1 or 2 days in the north, and 3 or 4 days in Jerusalem. That's how I would break it up. And it's easy to go back to the airport to leave the country from Jerusalem. It's only about a 45-minute cab ride.
Now, let's do that again in more detail. So Tel Aviv, modern city. I think of it almost a Miami Beach of Israel. I don't know how correct my picture is, but I always get the pictures of the beaches there. What do you do in Tel Aviv?
I would say in some ways it looks like Miami Beach, and in a lot of other ways it's Israel's New York.
Okay.
Tel Aviv is a great place to get a sense of modern secular Israel. It was really the main city that a lot of the founders of the state back in the late 1800s and early 1900s up to the founding of the state in 1948 were based. So you can see a lot of Zionist history, the founding of the state, but it's also a center of what's called Bauhaus architecture.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay.
One of the nicknames of the city is the White City. And it's actually designated such by UNESCO, the UN cultural body. A type of architecture that was very prominent, actually, in your Miami Beach comparison is apt because it looks a little like Art Deco architecture. And to some degree, Tel Aviv is the center of culture for the country. It plays in a world-class orchestra, the Israel Philharmonic. And it's just a great place to go clubbing. Like New York, Tel Aviv is the city that never sleeps. And so great restaurants, great nightlife, that promenade walk along the beach. And then just south of it, actually part of the city of Tel Aviv, is Jaffa, which is an 8,000-year-old city. And it's now part of the municipality of Tel Aviv-Jaffa, combined city. And so you can still get ancient history there.
And Jaffa's an old Phoenician city?
It is. It was actually mentioned repeatedly in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
where Jonas, the prophet, set out to try to escape the call of God.
That didn't work out so well, as I recall.
That didn't work out so well. Now he ended up being thrown from the boat. The story has still had a happy ending. Mentioned that Solomon had the timbers to build the temple brought in through Jaffa.
Right, okay.
But the old quarter of the city has become a major artist gallery, and so it's a fascinating place to wander in and look in these little art galleries and these little shops. And it's a delightful place. It's one of the most romantic spots in Israel, actually, with that incredible view up the coast of the city of Tel Aviv spread out in front of you. It's really quite spectacular.
Now, one thing you said that I think is going to catch a couple people by surprise is you use the word Israel and secular together. And I think a lot of people's picture is, since there are so many religions centered on this tiny country, that it must be a very religious country.
That is actually a great surprise to many people, probably maybe the biggest surprise for many people, including American Jews.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of Israel's Jewish population, and of course Israel is this incredible mosaic, the majority of the country's Jewish population is in fact secular. They might go to synagogue for a short time on Yom Kippur,
mm-hmm.
but other than that, non-religious. Being Jewish for them is a national and ethnic identity, and of course, that's now part of being Israeli. There is an ultra-Orthodox population centered
right.
mainly in Jerusalem, but also in a suburb of Tel Aviv, there's a major community, and up in the north there are some communities, and that's about 15% of the population, the Jewish population.
Oh,
and another 15% are traditional and Orthodox, but not ultra-Orthodox. And so that's the basic demographic of the Jewish population. And then, of course, you add about 20% of the population of Israel is Palestinian Arab, mostly Muslim, but also some Christian. And then you have a variety of other religious groups. There's a wonderful analogy that the head of the Peace Kindergarten at the Jerusalem International YMCA used. She said that you Americans think of yourselves as a melting pot. We're more like a salad. Tomato never forgets that it's a tomato, and the cucumber knows it's a cucumber, but you put us all together and you toss in some lemon and some olive oil, we make a wonderful salad. And I think that's a great description of Israel. It's a mosaic more than a melting pot.
Interesting. Okay. And we'll talk more when we get to Jerusalem about the Peace Kindergarten, because I really do want you to share more about that with the listeners. Anything else we need to know about or do in Tel Aviv? We didn't talk about nightlife, for instance.
It is definitely the place for nightlife. I'm, in all honesty, going to bed at 11 o'clock kind of guy, so I can't claim to have a lot of direct experience with it. But friends who love it, genuinely, you can go all night, and it's very, very lively and thriving. I think you're Miami Beach. Miami Beach and New York had a love child. It would look a lot like Tel Aviv.
Okay.
A very, very fun place.
And then you went north from there, as I recall.
Yes, to the city of Haifa. Haifa sits on the slopes of Mount Carmel, just mentioned also repeatedly in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of tourists miss Haifa. Haifa is more of an industrial city. In fact, there's an old saying in Israel that Tel Aviv plays and Jerusalem prays, but Haifa works.
Okay.
And it is industrial down in the port area particularly, but the views of that bay, and I always stay at a small little hotel called the Dan Gardens Haifa up on the top of Mount Carmel, and it's an inexpensive little boutique hotel, nothing fancy. But on that balcony, the view of this crescent-shaped bay is so breathtaking, I typically can't pull myself off of it. I'll sit out there sipping a beer for 2 or 3 hours just watching the sunset behind the mountain and the city lights come on. It's just breathtaking. And maybe because people in Haifa don't experience as many tourists, they tend to be very warm, very friendly. It's gotten to be a much better city to go eat out in, a lot of neat, fun restaurants. The Baha'i Gardens, the world center of the Baha'i faith, is in Israel, and their headquarters are in Haifa. And the Baha'is have developed a 19-stepped terraced garden that runs all the way from the top of Mount Carmel to the port area, down the face of this mountain. And it is the most breathtakingly beautiful garden I've ever seen. I literally will watch people come up to the top and look at it and watch their jaws drop. It's just magnificent. Haifa is a city, in my view, people often miss but shouldn't.
Interesting. Okay. I was a little surprised when you put it on the itinerary. So interesting to know. You mentioned restaurants. Any particular restaurants you recommend either? And we should add in Tel Aviv, since I didn't ask that question there.
I'll give you one in each city. They're my favorites in each city. In Tel Aviv, there's a wonderful restaurant called Orna and Ella, named after the two women owners. It's on Schenken Street, which is sort of a trendy, yuppie section of the city. And it is just a great, small, nothing fancy about it, but does wonderfully innovative dishes. It does comfort food, but with style. And particularly, don't miss the yam pancakes as an appetizer. They're to die for. In Haifa, my favorite restaurant is down in what's called the German Colony, down toward the port area. The German Colony was the remnants of settlements. There's several throughout the country, of a group called the German Templars, not to be confused with the Knights Templar from the Crusades.
Okay.
They were Protestants who believed in resettling the Holy Land. very interesting history, and they developed these very interesting, distinct buildings. They're really quite beautiful. And they're gone now. They were all mass deported during World War II because they were allied with the Nazis. But the buildings remain, and it's in that district. This restaurant's called Douzan, D-O-U-Z-A-N. I'm trying to remember from memory here. I think the name of the owner is Fadi Najjar. He's an Israeli Arab. He has to be experienced. He's quite flamboyant and quite the entertainer and is known for sort of smooching every guest that comes in. I saw him smooch men, women, Israeli soldiers, American sailors on Liberty. It didn't seem to matter. Everybody knows him and everybody loves him, and the food was terrific. And the other nice piece of that is you sit outside if the weather's allowing it, and the view, you're at the base of that Baha'i garden. And at nighttime, it is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life, how that garden is lighted up the face of the mountain at night. And the street that this restaurant is on dead ends right at the beginning of the garden. And so you've got this view up the face of the mountain, and it's entrancing. Haifa, a very interesting thing to see, to experience again some of modern Zionist history, the history of the founding of the State of Israel, is the clandestine immigration museum, which Haifa had a major role in the years between the end of World War II and during World War II, when the British were preventing Jewish immigration up until the founding of the state, because it was Israel's major port. It still is Israel's major port. There's a wonderful, small, interactive museum that gives you a feel for that struggle, and it's very moving and very interesting. Many people don't know that history, and so it's very enlightening to the kind of passion that the founders of Israel brought to their mission to create a place so that something like the Holocaust could never happen again.
And if you don't know that history, actually a good movie to rent, put on your Netflix, would be Exodus with Paul Newman.
Yes. One has to understand you're seeing one side of that story.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
It was certainly, when I saw the film and read the book when I was in seventh grade, it was part of where I started to fall in love with Israel.
You went from there over to that lake that has at least four names that I've counted here. I think we're talking about the Sea of Galilee, which is Lake Tiberias or Lake Genesaret, and then you had a fourth name, which is the modern name.
The modern name is Lake Kinneret, A-I-N-N-E-R-E-T. And it's from the Hebrew word kinor, which is harp. And it's because you get varied explanations, either that it's shaped like a harp, which it is to some degree, or that the sounds of the waves lapping are as lulling as a harp. So Israelis, they'll simply call it the Kinneret or Lake Kinneret, but particularly Christians tend to refer to it as the Sea of Galilee. And the main city there is Tiberias. Tiberias is a city, in all honesty, is not all that remarkable. The lake itself is gorgeous. When you come from the east, you can go through Nazareth, which is, of course, of interest to many Christians and many people generally. You come up over this rise, and because Lake Kinneret and the Dead Sea sit in what's called the Great African Rift, this very deep valley, they're both well below sea level, you come up over a rise, and then nestled in these hills is this just shimmering blue lake. And there was a traditional Jewish saying that God created the seven seas, but the Kinneret is his jewel. And you can see where that comes from. It's just gorgeous. Tiberias itself is not such a special city. It's a little run down in places, but it makes a very good base to explore the region. There are some other choices. There are guest houses and kibbutz guest houses in the region, including several that are right on the lake itself, if people are interested in that. But Tiberias is convenient. That's really the reason I recommend it. And there's a wonderful hotel there, a little pricier than I usually spend, called the Scots Hotel. It's owned by the Church of Scotland, or the Presbyterian Church in the United States. It's been recently renovated, and it's quite beautiful, but it's also, unfortunately, the prices have gone with it. So it's a little out of my traditional budget, but for a couple of days, if someone wants to splurge, it's a wonderful place to stay.
Okay.
It is not kosher, though, I should say, for anyone listening, for whom that's important. That's an issue in Israel, obviously, for religiously observant Jews. The vast majority of hotels are kosher, but because this is a church-owned one, this one is not.
And I assume that's well posted and on the information for any particular hotel or restaurant.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And certainly people for whom this is important also know to ask.
Sure.
But I just didn't want to at least flag that for that particular site. The Kinneret, when you're there, I think the main thing I recommend to people is, if you have a rental car, which makes this so much easier, and I strongly recommend at least for the trip to the north. Let me say this about rental cars. In Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem, having a rental car is not only not needed, but it's an active hassle. It's not worth it. The traffic is insane. So I recommend people get a rental car when they're leaving Tel Aviv. And it's very easy to do that for the trip up north, and then drop it off the minute you arrive in Jerusalem and use public transport and taxis within the city. But here, one of the great things is to do a day circuit around the lake, particularly for Christians. this is going to be the place where they most resonate with the life of Jesus of Nazareth. It's really quite lovely. There are many sites. Jesus' whole ministry, with the exception of the last week of his life, was based in this area. And you'll see site after site after site that resonates for Christians. But even for Jews, there's a lot of Jewish history in that area as well.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Jews are also, especially American Jews, who've grown up knowing a lot about Christian practices, are also just interested in seeing the Christian sites as well. And so that makes a really great day. And that can also be a base to explore the Golan, the area that Israel conquered from Syria in 1967,
sure.
which is physically fascinating. There's a site there called Gamla, which is sometimes called the Masada of the North, where in the great revolt against Rome in 66 to 70 CE or AD, the Romans laid siege to it, and unlike Masada, where about 1,000 people died, something like almost 10,000 people, according to the historian Josephus, were either killed by the Romans or threw themselves to their deaths at the far end of this ridge. That is an amazing site to hike to, and very powerful, and it's physically gorgeous. It sits in this gorge. Gamla comes from the Hebrew word gamal for camel because it looks like the hump of a camel. And griffin vultures that have a wingspan of 12 feet soar on these thermal currents. I had one swoosh over my head, no more than about 10 feet over my head. I actually hit the dirt because it was so large. They don't harm you. I mean, they're just glorious to watch, and that's one of the main nature preserves that protects them. So there's a lot of natural beauty to see in that area as well as really resonant history.
But they are vultures, so you want to keep moving so they know you're alive, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Good to
know.
They
seem to find plenty of other targets. I've never heard of them bothering a person.
And then we head down to Jerusalem.
Yes. There are a couple of ways of going. You can go down through the Jordan Valley, which, while it passes through the West Bank, passes through areas that are under Israeli control, and I think it's quite safe. Or you can go through what's called pre-1967 Israel, or inside the Green Line, to use the phrase Israelis use. And you can even stop and see, for instance, Megiddo, which is a very important site, Armageddon in the New Testament, on the way. So there's different ways you can go and see things on the way. If you go through the Jordan Valley, you can stop at an incredible Roman Jewish city called Beit She'an that's in the Jordan Valley, and it's just unbelievable ruins that have been excavated. A Colosseum that seated something like 10,000 people that's still largely intact, and that's really quite breathtaking. But then you make the ascent to Jerusalem. One of the things that people see pretty quickly is that when the Bible, particularly the Psalms, refers to going up to Jerusalem.
Simply
referring to a spiritual journey, but that any direction to Jerusalem is, in fact, up. It's quite a steep ascent. Jerusalem sits about 1,000 meters elevation. If you're starting, for instance, from the Dead Sea, you're starting at about 400 meters below sea level to 1,000 meters above sea level in about a 45-minute drive. So it's quite winding, the roads. And then you're in the Holy City, which is really a quite extraordinary experience for almost everyone. Certainly everyone I've taken with me found it almost emotionally overcoming. There's even a condition called the Jerusalem syndrome.
Right.
Of people who have emotional collapses because they're in Jerusalem.
Right. And become modern-day messiahs. Or
right. Or they believe they're someone, they're Isaiah or Jesus or Saladin or whatever.
Right.
And
to pick your religion, yeah.
The established medical treatment is to get the person out of Jerusalem. And then they generally recover.
Interesting.
I'm not saying that to scare off your listeners, because the overwhelming majority of people don't have that reaction. But I will say that I find the experience of being in Jerusalem, just walking around in the streets or sitting in a restaurant and looking at the palm trees or the old city walls at night, sometimes so full emotionally, I find myself almost near tears the entire time. I'm not one given to hyperbole, but there truly is no place in the world like Jerusalem. There's no place as holy to as many people. And even if you're not particularly religious, it's awfully hard not to be taken up with the enormity of the history of that city and the stunning mosaic that is the city today. One of the things I recommend to people is stop and have a sandwich or a drink by the Jaffa Gate and just watch for 2 hours as the city goes by. The things you will see, I can't imagine another place in the world as diverse with as much of a parade of humanity passing before you. It's really quite an emotional experience. So I think that's why some people, in fact, can't handle it.
Now, the Jaffa Gate, Jerusalem's divided into three parts. Which part are we in at that point?
And actually, it's divided in more than three, depending on how you're going to define it.
Okay.
The almost all Jewish, more modern part of the city is called the New City.
Right.
And this was the part of the city that was part of Israel from 1948 to 1967. Then there's East Jerusalem, which is the predominantly Palestinian section that was in Jordan up until the 1967 war. And then there's the Old City, which is tiny. It's less than a square mile. It's the walled Old City, and this is the part that has all the holy sites to the three great Abrahamic faiths.
Mm-hmm.
are all in this tiny area, less than a square mile, that it carries so much weight emotionally that people are always stunned to see how small it is. And then within the old city, the reason I said there are more parts, there are then four quarters within the old city, which aren't walled off in any way. There's just traditional ways of understanding the old city, and that's the Christian quarter, the Muslim quarter, the Jewish quarter, and the Armenian quarter. So it's a city with many, many communities.
And then you were staying someplace very interesting in Jerusalem, and I'd like you to tell us a little more about that.
I've stayed almost every trip at the Jerusalem International YMCA, which has a hotel there called the Three Arches Hotel. And for American listeners particularly, this is not like staying in a YMCA here, which tends to be more like transient housing. The YMCA was built by the British in 1931. It's on King David Street, right across the street from the King David Hotel, which is the poshest hotel of the city. When the president's in Israel, generally the president's at the King David. In fact, when I was there in May, President Bush was right across the street for several days of my visit. It's a physically stunning building. The British used the same architect who designed the Empire State Building. And it's a breathtaking building. The building's often referred to as a sermon in stone. And I recommend visitors, even if you're not staying there, go to the YMCA and try to arrange for a tour of the building from someone who knows the building, because the symbolism in it is so rich. And it's specifically, while it is obviously a Christian institution in origin, the YMCA is extremely careful and very dedicated to its intercommunal mission. And so the board has Jews, Muslims, and Christians on it. Its current director is Jewish. They also have an institution that is world-renowned, and that's the Gan HaShalom in Hebrew, or the Peace Kindergarten. And it is a kindergarten and preschool that's very carefully balanced between Jewish and Palestinian Arab students, with a number of expatriate children as well. I first learned of that when I was there in 1993, and I just arrived, and I was frankly jet-lagged, and I was trying to sleep in a little bit, and I heard these kids right outside my window, and I thought, oh, Lord, I really just want to sleep. And then I heard something really unusual, which was Hebrew and Arabic being spoken at the same time. And I speak Hebrew, and don't speak Arabic, but I can recognize it. That's not a sound you often hear in Israel, of children speaking Hebrew and Arabic together. And I looked out the window, and that's when I first learned of this, and it's become a real passion of mine. I actually have encouraged my church to start financially supporting it, because it's a very expensive program, because each classroom also has a Jewish and Arab teacher.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm.
Children are taught bilingually. They're taught each other's customs.
Hmm.
And so it's expensive tuition, and particularly a lot of Arab families can't afford it. And so that threatens the bi-national character of the program, which is so vital. But the hotel actually has been a bit run down since the fall off in tourism in the early 2000s. It needs to be renovated, I will be honest with people. If you need someplace that's kind of spiffy and makes you feel spoiled, this would not be your place, right now at least. But there is a mission to that organization that I really support. I remember talking to them during the really bad years of the early 2000s, where the suicide bombings were going off in the heart of Jerusalem.
Right.
And they would talk about how hard they worked to keep an island of peace and sanity for these children, that they would even sometimes hear the explosions and would try so hard to keep the children calm, to keep the children engaged, to keep the family still sending their children. The institution was actually nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize one year.
Hmm.
And I think deservedly. I wish they would have won it, because it's an amazing place.
Interesting. In Jerusalem, anything else that we should hit as a highlight? We need to start winding this down, so I've got a series of questions for you.
I would say this. On the first day of Jerusalem, if you've never been before, go to just inside the Jaffa Gate. There's a tour agency called Zion Walking Tours.
Okay.
And they do a half-day, four-quarters walking tour of the Old City. It's a great way to orient yourself to the entire Old City, all four quarters. And then you can decide what you want to see further on your own. I recommend that people, particularly Christians, but not just Christians, go to the Mount of Olives.
Okay.
And experience that, all the different churches and the Jewish cemetery that's on there. And then I also recommend people go to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial on the western side of the city, because it's a very powerful, obviously very emotional memorial to why does Israel exist and to that experience. There's a new historical museum there that's really very well done. I recommend that. The Israel Museum, which is near Yad Vashem, is also another wonderful stop. It's the site of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And most of it's closed right now for renovation, but there's still some interesting things to see there. And, of course, I think it's sometime later this year or early 2010, perhaps, that the museum will reopen. So I would encourage people to see that as well.
The best day you've had in Israel?
Oh, my goodness. You're asking me to choose.
Yes, I
am. It's so hard to pick. That's very difficult. I would say the best day I've had in Israel was probably my first day in Jerusalem in 1988, and I was on that Four Quarters walking tour. We're walking through the Jewish quarter. We had just stopped and had a little bite to eat and something to drink. And we're walking down a staircase, almost in a labyrinth, the old city's walls, you know, the old city's streets and passageways are so narrow. I go down these stairs and around the corner, and all of a sudden, spread out in front of me was Temple Mount on the Western Wall.
Hmm.
Something I had dreamed about seeing my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I guess, my own little Jerusalem syndrome moment, because I burst into tears. And the guide was a very sweet man, and he just reached over and put his arm around my shoulders. And obviously, I was happy. He knew that. And I think he's actually fairly used to that. That's not an uncommon reaction. But to see so much, the emotion was so overwhelming. And I remember gasping. And then in 2005, when I took a woman I work with for her first visit, I got to do that moment with her because I knew where I was now.
Right.
And I said, I want to show you something, Joy. And we went down the steps, and I'm looking at her, glancing, trying to be subtle about it. She has no idea where I'm taking her. And we get to that point, and I heard her just go, and she had the same reaction. It never gets old.
Huh.
The spiritual power of that place is something that really does get in one system and you can't lose.
The biggest surprise, if I go to Israel, what's going to be the biggest surprise for me?
I think the biggest surprise for almost everyone is that the situation on the ground is nothing like you're going to expect from media reports.
Okay.
That it's a safe country, that it's not racked with violence, that people aren't walking around in helmets, that it feels so normal. Every person I've taken with me, and I've taken several now, has had that reaction. And the other is, I think, the contrast of the ancient and the new in Israel, because in some ways the country is 60 years old. Just observed its 60th anniversary in May, and I was lucky enough to be there for that. But in other ways, of course, it's thousands of years old. And you see that in some ways, they're actually comical at times. One of my favorites on my first trip was being in Caesarea, Herod's capital, the building, mm-hmm. the seat of government for Pontius Pilate.
Caesarea Philippi? Mm-hmm.
No, actually, Caesarea Philippi.
Oh, the other
is
one.
In Galilee.
Okay.
This is Caesarea Maritima.
Got it. Okay.
On the Mediterranean
right.
coast, just north of Tel Aviv. On these Crusader fortifications, which are, of course, 900 years old, on the seawall, there's this giant orange sign hanging that says in Hebrew and English, Disco. But I just don't think you can see this any place. Or walking out of the Jaffa Gate after a whole day in the old city, and I'm walking back to the YMCA where I'm staying, and I hear all these car horns honking because it's rush hour in Jerusalem, so all the cars are all piled up. And what they're honking at is a man who's got on his camel and is taking it back into the old city. And it's that juxtaposition of the very, very modern, and Israel's a very first world, modern, high-tech country, with the ancient, I think, tends to constantly surprise people in a delightful way. And then there's always stumbling on things that resonate with something you've heard about your whole life and you're not expecting it. First time I was driving through Galilee on my way to Lake Kinneret in Tiberias, I see this sign saying Kfar Kana, K-A-N-A. So I think, okay, a little Arab village. Well, then I see the big sign saying Welcome to Cana, and I realize this is the Cana of the wedding in Cana in the
right.
New Testament,
mm-hmm.
Gospel of John. And that happens all the time. Something you've heard about, read about all your life, you stumble on. And you go, oh, my gosh, that's this place. It gives a sense of constant wonder, I find.
Hmm.
And I still do after 9 trips.
One warning you would give?
One warning I would give is not to try to see everything.
Okay.
And I think this is true of travel generally, but particularly Israel. Not to view this as some checklist of sites that I have to check all these off. Because I think people who try to see everything sometimes end up missing everything.
Okay.
That they don't never can savor or experience something.
They don't take that 2 hours to sit there and watch the Jaffa Gate.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I am a Christian. My fellow Christian listeners, is don't be so determined to see, quote-unquote, the Holy Land that
okay.
you miss Israel.
Okay, interesting.
I've seen Christians think, well, I want to see what it's just like in the Bible. It's like, well, there's a modern country here now. And see that, too. I mean, don't miss the sites that are important to your
mm-hmm.
faith. That's central to many people's experience of Israel. But don't skip Tel Aviv. Don't miss this incredible experiment of bringing Jews from 120 different countries and rebuilding a homeland for them. Because there is no place in the world that's done that either. That's also a unique thing about Israel. And I've seen Christian pilgrims who were so determined to, quote-unquote, walk in the footsteps of Jesus that they managed to miss the country along the way.
Hmm.
And I think it's very possible to do both.
Okay.
And so I always encourage my Christian friends, don't miss modern Israel on the way to having the spiritual experience.
You came back at some point and decided you were going to write a travel guide for Israel. Not publish it, but to give it out to people. Why?
Anybody who wants it for free, I'm happy to do that. Well, it started actually, a friend of mine was going, and I started writing what I thought would be just be two or three pages of tips. But I'm a lawyer. I'm from the profession that writes a 35-page document and calls it a brief. And so even the very first version was 12 pages long before I was stopped. As you may tell, getting me to talk about Israel is not the problem. Getting me to stop talking is the problem. Over the 2 years that I've made trips, it's now grown to 42 pages. Starting back, I think it was in 2004, on TripAdvisor and Frommers.com, I've just offered it to anybody who wants it, and I send it out. I probably send out about an average of two or three copies a day, so about 1,000 a year. And I do it because I'm so passionate about this country, and I want people to experience it on their own terms, because they'll have a different experience than I had. Everyone does. But not to be scared off by the news, to not believe that it's somehow a war zone, and to understand that for so many of us who've experienced it, it becomes addictive. So I'll make the offer to your listeners. Anyone who wants a copy of the guide, I may regret this, but anyone who wants a copy of the guide can write me at Labatt, L-A-B-A-T-T, like the beer, but that's actually an abbreviation for labor attorney, which is what I do, at fuse.net. And I will be happy to email you a copy of the guide. And there's no strings. No, I don't do this business. It's just sharing my passion for the country and helping people who want to go there do so.
You've been there 8 times, I think we said?
Nine times. My most recent visit was this past May, and I'm planning on returning again in 2010.
And you've taken lots of pictures.
I have.
What's the one picture that really takes you back there? You look at that picture and you're in danger of getting Jerusalem syndrome or Tel Aviv syndrome.
Well, I would say it probably is. Oh, I can tell you, from my first trip would have been the day I went to what's called Mount Scopus, so-called Hebrew Har HaTzofim. It's the Hill of Views. It's where Hebrew University is, and it overlooks the old city from the eastern side. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there on a wall at Hebrew University watching a sunset over the city, and at the same time heard the call of the muezzin, the call to prayer from the mosques all over the city, and heard the bells ringing at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And if I would have been in the city, I also would have seen Orthodox Jewish men hurrying on their way to prayer at the Western Wall. And it's that mosaic, and I just snapped a picture of that. And, of course, it's a beautiful sunset picture. But what I would remember is all those sounds and all those sights, and that this is the mosaic, the rich mosaic that is that city. And that would have been – that's the part that I think most remains in my heart.
Okay. And here's an impossible task for you. If you had to summarize Israel in 3 words, what 3 words would you use?
If I have to count prepositions as a word, I would say, I'll delete the preposition. So, beautiful faith home. There we go.
Okay.
It's because it has a physical beauty. It is a place of faith to so many people. And for many people, surprisingly so, maybe they wouldn't have even thought that. There feels like in some way their heart and their spirit's at home there. And obviously pilgrims have felt that way for millennia, and I think will continue to do so.
Douglas, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your love of Israel.
You're very welcome, Chris. I wish you and your listeners well, and happy travels.
The internet resource for this week is an obvious one, and that is Douglas's Guide to Israel. And Douglas has allowed me to put that up on the Amateur Traveler site, so those of you who are too shy to send him an email don't need to. You can just click on the link in the show notes to get that guide, save that PDF file to your hard drive, and that should give you a lot of information about Israel. I would also encourage you to think about supporting the Peace Preschool, especially in this week where I just woke up this morning to see headlines of Israel may invade Gaza. Anything that promotes peace in that area, I think, is something that is worth supporting. In news from the community, I had a comment from Ali who asked, is there going to be a podcast on minority solo travel experiences? And I hadn't really thought about that. That is something that is outside my experience, except in such that in my neighborhood, I'm actually a minority. I live in a predominantly Asian neighborhood. But if that is something that a lot of people are interested in, I'm obviously not qualified to do it, but I could look for a guest for that. So let me know if that's something that resonates with you as well. And then I did get a letter from Michelle that said, thank you, thank you, thank you for the wonderful informative podcast about Scotland. Eden did a great job of describing the sights, sounds, and food. I would have loved to see more pictures in your chapters feature, or perhaps it isn't working properly for me, but the one you had up there of a castle is lovely. Food is always one of the topics I love to hear more about when you do interviews, and Eden's description of haggis did not interest me to try it. For those of you who are not familiar, if you are on iTunes or on an iPod, you can see pictures. Now, Michelle is saying she looked at the chapters and only saw a few pictures. That's because there was a request a while back that I not put chapters in for every single picture. So there are, with any given episode, something like 36 different pictures or links if you're in that version, if you're in iTunes or if you're in an iPod that can display those. Obviously, some of you are in the MP3 player, you're on a Zoom, you're on a computer, and you can't see those. But remember, iTunes is free, so if you are listening on a computer, that is a possibility. And then that gives you the opportunity to have an illustrated version of the podcast. And I put in a couple hours doing that work, so if you guys appreciate that or get a chance to see that, that'd be great. With that, we'll bring this episode of The Amateur Traveler to a close. Don't forget about the writing contest we're doing here in January. Tell me about your favorite city, and you get a chance to win a book about Mexico City called The First Stop in the New World, and more details about that in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. Feel free to send me an email or comment on this particular episode, and as always, thanks so much for listening. See